today, the latest market update, and some thoughts on the Fed. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the latest post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. So the S&P 500 and the Dow closed at record highs on Friday on a wave of late buying in tech and strengthening in bank stocks as investors look ahead to the start of quarterly earnings seasons that start next week. The S&P 500 rose 0.73% to close at a record level of 4,127. And the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 0.89%, notching up a significant rise to an all-time high of 33,800. The Nasdaq Composite was also up 0.51%. The Labor Department reported that its producer price index for final demand increased 1% last month. That's a two-month high and significantly above economists' forecasts of 0.5%. The latest signs of inflation boosted US bond yields and briefly exerted pressure on growth sectors like tech, but the spike in yields ran out of steam and that helped the tech sector to claw back losses as the Federal Reserve has persistently downplayed the risk of runaway inflation. So the question is, are the inflationary forces gathering like so many believe, or is it just a temporary blip? Well, there would be upward pressure on prices from supply chain bottlenecks that may be passed on to consumers, but we think that the effect will be temporary, Fed Chairman Jerome Powell said at a virtual IMF panel discussion on Thursday. The rising costs that consumers will likely have to bear will not be repeated as the supply chain will adapt and become more efficient, he added. So nothing to see here. Move on. The 10-year yield closed near its highs of the day, but the outlook for rates is not one centred on big moves in either direction, suggesting a disorderly climb in the yields, fears of which, of course, had previously worried tech stocks in particular. This is unlikely now. Our target range for the 10-year Treasury yield is between 1.5 and 2% by the end of the year, said the analyst at Alliance Investment Management in an interview. And these yields are still attractive relative to other sovereign bonds, so there is still going to be some buying pressure for US Treasuries. Financials were led higher by regional banking stocks ahead of key quarterly results from major Wall Street operators, which you're of course expecting next week, with JP Morgan, Citigroup, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, and Goldman Sachs all set to report. The banks are expected to show strong performance from trading and dealing activities, with the latter boosted by the Special Purpose Acquisition Company, or SPAC, frenzy. This is an interesting phenomenon where essentially investors are invited to invest in something which is not yet clear. In other words, a future prospective investment. Interesting question as to how legal that actually is. In industrials, Boeing was in the spotlight after the aircraft maker reportedly urged 16 airline customers to ground the company's 737 MAX jets, citing electrical issues. The 737 MAX aircraft was recertified airworthy back in November last year, following months and months of issues after two deadly crashes. And in other news, Tesla appears to be reaping rewards for its big play on China following the launch of its Giga factory in 2019, as the electric automaker sold 69,280 Shanghai-made Model 3S and Model Ys, according to a recent report. The volatility index was down 1.53%. to 1669, which is a new 52-week low. Gold futures for June delivery was down 0.83% to 1743. Silver was down 1.06% to 2531. Copper was down 1.16% to to 4.047. And crude oil was down 0.44% to 59.34. As contracts are on track to post a drop of between 2 and 3% this week following the decision late last week by the Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries and its allies, including Russia, to gradually increase supplies by 2 million barrels per day between May and July. The Euro-US dollar was down 0.06% to 1.1905, and the US dollar futures index was up 0.1% to 92.16. Now, the New York Fed released their latest nowcasting estimates, which came in at 6% for 2021 quarter one and 1.5% for 2021 quarter two. And news from this week's data releases decreased the nowcast for 2021 quarter one by 0.2 percentage points and decreased the nowcast for 2021 quarter two by 0.1 percentage points. Their model produces this nowcast of GDP growth, incorporating, they say, a wide range of macroeconomic data as it becomes available. And they claim their platform provides a model-based counterpart to the more routine forecast produced by the banks, which have traditionally been based on, well, expert knowledge. Now, there's a few interesting observations to be made about what the Fed has been up to. And I just want to highlight a few of those and perhaps deal with some of the more outlandish claims that have been bubbling around YouTube over the last few days. We know, for example, that the Federal Reserve recently discontinued updating the M1 and M2 weekly money supply series and is instead updating the series monthly. Now, the question is why? Are they trying to hide something? Well, I think perhaps not. It's more that this is a change in attitude from the Fed and how much really they think that money supply is an important measure. Chairman Powell has been pretty explicit that money doesn't matter based on his recent testimony. He's basically said that money and the measurement of money doesn't really matter because it's unrelated to inflation. Now, that would, of course, shake some monetarists. These money supply series have been published since the 1970s, and the fact that the Fed has changed the publishing frequency on M1 and M2 from weekly to monthly really demonstrates a change in perspective. In principle, they don't think the data is that important. They want to basically move away from the theories that the monetarists would have put together. They want to, frankly, bury Milton Friedman once and for all, and their preference would probably be not to report any monetary statistics at all. And in fact, I think there's a lot of merit in that because I don't believe that money supply is actually a very relevant metric anymore. It's clearly not driving the momentum relating to inflation that many perhaps would have thought previously. And it really does underscore whether in fact the world has moved on. So rather than this being some conspiracy about essentially not reporting in a timely fashion, it really, to my mind, just reflects reality. Now, there are two really interesting points about the Fed's changes to the reporting. The first is that they've changed the periodicity. The other is that they have adjusted some of the aggregates. In fact, they have moved the savings deposits. And as a result of that, this is a bit of a serious break. But I don't think we should read too much into this. This is not a fundamental change. This is more about tidying up the data. So I have to say that I think those who are claiming that this is some conspiracy by the Fed is missing the point. Now, in other news relating to the Fed, there was an interesting speech by Lori Logan at the annual primary dealer meeting on April the 8th. Now, it's quite a long speech. I'm not going to go through all of it, but there's a really, really interesting bit which I want to highlight. One of the interesting observations is where they're operating on the yield curve. As our Treasury purchases transition to a more proportional allocation, there were still sectors of the curve that we refrain from purchasing. For example, the desk generally has avoided purchasing bills, both to avoid increasing scarcity value of those securities arising from strong investor demand, and because bill purchases have relatively little impact on financial conditions. Even in this steadier operating regime, we continue to adjust our purchase approach consistent with our principles. For example, we conduct periodic reviews of our allocations across purchase sectors and make modest changes in response to the evolving market environment. During the past year, issuance of Treasury securities has increased markedly as the US Treasury has sought to fund pandemic-related fiscal stimulus expenditures. Even with our new issuance, the distribution of Treasury coupons outstanding has been fairly stable given the large outstanding stock of Treasury debt. However, modest shifts have occurred. In particular, the introduction of the 20-year Treasury bond has increased amounts outstanding around the 20-year maturity point. In addition, the pace of increase in TIPS, which is the short-term stuff, has been slower relative to nominal coupon securities. With net issuance expected to remain high in the near term, we anticipate that the composition of outstanding supply will continue to evolve. As a result, we plan to make minor technical adjustments to our purchase sectors and increase the frequency at which we update purchase allocations to remain roughly proportional to the outstanding supply of nominal coupon securities and TIPS. We expect to announce these as part of a normal purchase calendar release in coming months. Now, there's an interesting observation there, and that is if they are indeed morphing their purchases out along the yield curve, this could be an indication that they're more likely to purchase at the longer end of the curve, which, of course, is something that a number of people have been calling for some time. And we'll see whether it translates into reality or not. But I found that quite a fascinating story. I want to make mention of just one other document. And this is the remarks of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York's annual primary dealer meeting, where Deputy Assistant Secretary for Federal Finance Brian Smith spoke. And it's quite a long speech. I'm not going to go through all of it, but it is quite interesting. Primary dealers, he said, as part of their relationship with the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, plays a significant role in underwriting Treasury securities issuance. Primary dealers also provide liquidity to investors in the secondary market. We're always happy to reiterate that the Treasury market remains the deepest and most liquid market in the world. This is no small part to the important role that you as primary dealers play in intermediating flows between Treasury and investors. This model has been in place for decades and we believe it remains as important as ever. In calendar year 2020, Treasury held more than 500 auctions for approximately $20 trillion worth of securities, raising more than $4 trillion in net new cash. Over 90% of the Treasury securities we auctioned were either awarded to primary dealers directly or facilitated by primary dealers through indirect awards. Even in the face of disruptions from the pandemic, including the unexpected shift to the work-from-home environment, you continue to support our auctions, allowing the process of raising unprecedented sums for the pandemic response to run smoothly. As we continue in 2021 with record auction sizes to finance the government's responses to COVID-19, your continued commitment to supporting the auction process and Treasury's robust financing mechanism is vital. And he concluded, in conclusion, we thank you again for all that you do to support the US Treasury market. Your commitment in helping Treasury finance the government through the auctions process is incredibly important during these unprecedented times. And let me stress that there is still a lot more work to do to understand potential vulnerabilities to Treasury market resilience, and we'll continue to incorporate your input into our analysis. So, 2 points there. The first is the critical role these primary dealers play in the US system. is important to understand. And secondly, of course, they are there essentially as a conduit into the broader markets. And this is how Treasury operates. Now, here's another snippet from the same speech. We also conducted our first auction of the reintroduced 20-year bond last May. While we announced our intention to issue the 20-year bond in January, prior to the crisis, the timing was fortuitous and highlighted the important value of maintaining flexibility to expanding financing if needed. Given our increased borrowing needs and efforts to term out, we auctioned $20 billion of the new issuance in May, compared to market expectations of around $14 billion. The initial and subsequent auctions of the 20-year bond have gone smoothly, and we've been satisfied with the developing secondary market liquidity of this benchmark. We expect liquidity to continue to improve as the market further adopts the 20-year bond for a variety of uses, akin to our other benchmarks. Let me just remind you of the implementation note issued on January the 27th, 2021. The Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve voted unanimously to maintain the interest rate paid on required and excess reserve balances at 0.1% effective from the 28th of January 2021. As part of its policy decision, the Federal Open Market Committee voted to authorize and direct the open market desk of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, until instructed otherwise, to execute transactions in the system open market account in accordance with the following domestic policy directives. Undertake open market operations as necessary to maintain the federal funds rate in the range of 0 to 0.25%. Increase the system open market account holdings of Treasury securities by $80 billion a month, and of agency mortgage-backed securities by $40 billion per month. Increase holdings of Treasury securities and agency MBS by additional amounts, and purchase agency commercial mortgage-backed securities as needed to sustain smooth functioning of markets for those securities. Conduct repurchase agreement operations to support effective policy implementation and the smooth functioning of short-term US dollar funding markets. Conduct overnight reverse repurchase agreement operations at an offering rate of 0% and with a pre-counterparty limit of $30 billion a day. The per-counterparty limit can be temporarily increased at the discretion of the chair. Rollover of auction at principal payments from the Federal Reserve's holding of Treasury securities, and reinvest all principal payments from the Federal Reserve's holding of agency debt and agency MBS in agency MBS, and allow modest deviations from stated amounts for purchases and reinvestments if needed for operational reasons, and engage in dollar roll and coupon swap transactions necessary to facilitate settlement of the Federal Reserve's agency MBS transactions. And in a related action, the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve voted unanimously to approve the establishment of the primary credit rate of the existing level of 0.25%. So the point again here is that they are committed to continuing to inject this liquidity into the system into the future. And talking of fascinating stories, there was also this. This is to do with the question of whether the Fed is being coy with regard to the availability of information. And again, I've seen a number of people suggest that they are tightening up on freedom of information, and indeed perhaps making it harder to get freedom of information requests processed. Well, I read this quite carefully. This is actually the underlying document, which basically highlighted that back in October last year, they published a notice of proposed rulemaking in the Federal Register, revising its rules regarding availability of information. And they had a public comment period of 60 days. Now, they did get a number of comments, and in the light of those comments, they've made some minor changes, but nothing much. But if you read through all of the things that they're proposing, I'm not going to go through this in a lot of detail at the moment, I would say that there is really not much to see here. And so trying to make this some platform to argue that the Fed is now being less transparent about what it's doing, I think is an overreach. And all I want to say is that, so far as I can see, this is more about just tidying up around the edges and improving the mechanisms and processes. There is really no fundamental intent here, in my view, to clamp down and reveal less information about their operations. Now, it is worth noting, of course, that the Fed is continuing to grow its balance sheet, not as fast as earlier on, but this plot just shows you that, in fact, the total balance sheet of the Fed is continuing to rise. And, of course, the latest from the Fed underscores further growth in the balance sheet. Elsewhere, Secretary Yellen released details of the Biden-Harris administration submission to Congress with regard to the president's priorities for fiscal year 2022 discretionary spending. The funding requests investment in core foundations to build our country's strength and advance key Treasury Department priorities, including ensuring that all Americans are treated fairly by the tax system, expanding programs that offer loans to startups and small businesses to promote affordable housing and community revitalization projects, and closing loopholes that allow illicit actors to evade scrutiny, masking their dealings and shielding their illegal activities, they said. If you're an individual taxpayer or a small business, it's much more difficult to navigate the financial services sector and America's tax system than if you're a large company, said Secretary Yellen. The president's funding request makes things fair. It injects capital into communities where capital is usually hard to come by. It will make paying taxes a more seamless process for millions of Americans, and it will make sure that corporations actually pay what they owe. Specifically, the president's financial year 22 discretionary request includes supporting a fair and equitable tax system at $13.2 billion for the Inland Revenue Service. That's 10.4% above the 2021 enacted level, which will increase oversight of high income and corporate tax returns to ensure compliance. And then investing in the American communities and small businesses by providing $330 million, an increase of 22.2% above 2021 enacted levels, for annual appropriations to support expanding the role of the Community Development Financial Institution, the CDIFs, which offer loans to startup and small businesses to promote the production of affordable housing and community revitalization projects, and also increasing corporate transparency and safeguarding the financial system by looking at loopholes in the financial reporting requirements and the corporate accountability, and to ensure that illicit actors don't evade scrutiny and mask their dealings. So 2022 discretionary requests includes $191 million for the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, $64 million above the 2021 enacted level, to create a database that tracks the ownership and control of certain companies and organizations and helps combat the use of complex corporate structures to shield illegal activity. These discretionary investments reflect only one element of the president's broader agenda, they said. In the coming months, the administration will release the president's budget, which will present a unified, comprehensive plan to address the overlapping crises we face in a fiscally and economically sustainable way. So we'll see where that leads. But it looks to me as though this is a bundle of ragbag things, many of which are laudable. But we wonder how well they will make progress. So I want to underscore the complexity that we're seeing here with the Treasury, the Fed, primary dealers, and other players all involved in building this weird pyramid of liquidity, which of course is driving the stock markets much higher, driving the bond markets, and potentially creating a precipitous pile of debt, which ultimately will have to be unwound. One reason why many people, including myself, believe the markets are one, overvalued, two, relatively unstable, and three, are probably due for a correction at some point. The question is, when does that correction come? And today, it's hard to know, because I suspect they'll go on doing these same tricks for quite some time to come. Now, over in London, on the day that Prince Philip died, stocks traded mostly lackluster. But the week was shaping up to be the best since January for the FTSE 100. It was down 0.38% to 6,932, but it gained 2.9% on the week, which put it on track for the strongest weekly return since a 6.3% gain in early January. Helping that out was a 1% drop this week for the pound, US dollar. And the losses for the pound tend to boost the FTSE, as many listed multinational companies derive revenue overseas. The index was weighed on Friday by losses for shares of British American Tobacco, down 2.54%. It actually fell 2.7% after JP Morgan downgraded the shares to neutral from overweight. And shares of Babcock International tumbled 7% after the Financial Times reported that the defence contractor was preparing to substantially write down the value of its assets. European stock markets edged lower on Friday, weighed by concerns that the region's patchy vaccination program will lead to a slow recovery from the COVID pandemic. The tone was set by a string of worse-than-expected readings for industrial production across the Eurozone, with German industrial production unexpectedly falling for a second month in February by 1.6%, and French output contracting 4.7% instead of growing by 0.5% as forecast. It would need an explosion of manufacturing and construction activity in March to prevent the German economy from falling into contraction in the first quarter of the year, according to ING analysts. Continental Europe has struggled to cope with a third wave of the COVID-19 virus, exaggerated by the region's lack of success in organising a concerted vaccination programme. This hasn't been helped by growing worries over the safety of one of the most prominent vaccines. Italy, Spain and Belgium have joined other European countries in limiting the use of the AstraZeneca vaccine, even after the European Medicines Agency on Wednesday repeated that the benefits of the drug outweighs the risks of very rare cases of blood clots. The lack of common guidelines within the EU over the use of the drug can only increase public hesitancy, slowing the chance of the region achieving widespread vaccination. The economic news elsewhere was more promising, with China's March factory gate prices rising at their fastest annual pace since July 2018, climbing 4.4% year on year, far above February's 1.7% growth. Now, in Australia, the markets here are still doing quite well, but nevertheless, the consequence of the much slower vaccine program and the implications, therefore, for economic growth and potentially maintaining border controls for a lot longer haven't really been factored in yet, in my view. I think we're going to see more of this ahead. The ASX 200 closed down 0.05% to 6,995. The ASX Financials 200 was up 0.07% to 6,191. The real estate trusts were up 0.65% to 1,467. And the Australian Volatility Index was down 4.48% to 1050. The S&P ASX 200 futures was up 0.45% to 6,978. Amongst the banks, ANZ was at 28.74. CBA was up 0.01% to 87.13. NAB was up 0.34% to 26.72. And Westpac was up 0.2% to 25.21. Among the regionals, the Bank of Queensland was up 0.11% to 8.73. Bendigo was down 0.1% to 10.22. Suncorp was up 0.19% to 10.34. and Macquarie was up 0.77% to 154.80. AMP was down 1.56% to 1.26. And Genworth Mortgage Insurer was down 1.2% to 247. McGrath was at 65 cents. And Yellow Brick Road was up 1.14% to 8.9 cents. AFG was down 3.15% to 277. And Mortgage Choice was down 0.52% to 1.915. Afterpay Touch was up 1.22% to 121.47. And Cymec was up 0.23% to 17.74. The Aussie US dollar was down 0.46% to 76.77. And the Euro Aussie dollar was up 0.39% to 1.5623. Looking at the bonds, the 2-year rate was down 14.77% to 0.075, and the 3-year bond was down 20.7% to 0.101, while the 10-year bond was up 2.19% to 1.733. So some of the pressure in terms of future rates may have come off a little. The gold Aussie dollar cross was down 0.19% to 2,289. And the Bitcoin Aussie cross was up 0.9% to 76,600. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you next time. And just before I go, a quick reminder that next Tuesday at 8 p.m. Sydney time, I'll be joined by mortgage broker Chris Bates as we discuss the very interesting developments in the Sydney property market recently. So mark your diary, and I'll see you on Tuesday.